Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated, and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will, or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million, what's today, Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Would not you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you're doing, you're wasting your time. Do you hear me? You're wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody. Don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, if you just do it 10 more times.
Today's podcast is titled Nine Friends Business Models. What Steve Harvey, and this is why I play this practically every morning, Harvey laid out is a very simple business plan. Now, let me tweak it a little bit. Well, now you need to tweak it. Because he laid it out real simple. And we want to duplicate this. This is what we're duplicating going into 2022. It started off with one person doing one thing successfully one time. And he earned $10. Now, it can be $10, it could be $100, it could be $1,000, whatever. But it's just one person doing successfully one thing. Everybody who's listened to this podcast and who will listen to this podcast has done several things successfully one time or more and have gotten paid for it. I like the fact that he used $10 because that's a small amount that anybody, even from a developing country, third world country, has done some kind of way translated in their currency. All right. So we're going to do some nine friends. We have a nine friends business model that we're doing. So I'm going to play a couple more audios, and then we're going to walk you through the one that we're currently working on.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow.
I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Okay, now, in that audio... It's another business model, which we call the Nine Friends business model. And the hybrid business model that we are using will be based on, we're taking something from Steve Harvey's 10x10 business model. We're taking something from the Nine Friends business model as well, and coming up with our own business model. It's a simple way. I mean, it's nothing extravagant. It's nothing fancy. But you can have some amazing results from it, and that's what we're working on. So, all right, that's the second business model here. Let's see. Let's go. Wait a minute. It's another business model I want you guys to, All right, bear with me now. My computer is slow to react sometimes. But the next business model that we're going to be modeling, we're about to play it here. I've played it several times before. But this is primarily for the benefit of the new people. Once again, we're taking parts from the 10x10, fundamentally speaking. And what I like about the 10x10 business model, it's a scaling business model. It allows you to take something very simple, cutting the grass for $10, but the guy's, and he has another audio here with one of his friends. That's what he did to become a millionaire. He used the example of one friend became a millionaire by cutting grass for $10, and another friend of his was cutting hair for like $10, and he became a millionaire. So the 10x10 business model allows you to scale. Okay. So we're going to be using that. Part of that methodology with what we do. All right, you don't have to go to college. You don't need an MBA in finance. You don't need to go to Wharton Business School or nothing like that. And we're not talking about you becoming a billionaire or a millionaire or whatever. We're just talking about something that you can start, that you've already done successfully. And then scale it from there. All right, here's our next business model.
Well, you've heard the phrase, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, Steve Shives knows it's true. He's made a fortune thanks to some old scrap parts from a beat-up bus, and it all became a million-dollar business.
Steve Shives turned his backyard business into a million-dollar company. in under 5 years.
I'm doing something that I love. I enjoy the fact that people appreciate it.
It wasn't always that way. When Steve and his wife Deirdre married, he was an unpaid associate pastor who earned money as a handyman.
I just couldn't quite make enough. And with that struggle, we started using credit cards.
I would use a credit card to buy groceries, put gas in the vehicle, and it wasn't just one credit card.
Before long, they were carrying $30,000 of debt.
I think we were just irresponsible in a lot of ways, in the ways that we spent money, because we still tithed. We were still faithful in our giving. In my mind, we were being good stewards by giving 10%. What I didn't know is that we were being bad stewards of the other 90.
When creditors started calling, Steve and Deirdre say they knew it was time to take a hard look at their finances.
I had this anger inside myself. You're the pastor of a church, and you're teaching people on tithing. And, you know, how in the world did you let this happen? And I said, God, I said, if you'll help me get out of this debt, I will never be in debt again, and I'll be faithful to whatever it is you give me.
Steve says that's when the Lord told him to cut his spending, increase his giving, and to tithe on the amount he needed to support his family.
God said, so if $1,000 a week is what you want, then $1,000 a week is what you have to sow towards.
I thought, well, if this is going to help us, and this is what God's told you to do, then we need to do it.
Steve began to work with their creditors to pay down their debt. Several companies gave him the option to settle for far less than he owed. With their debt reduced, the couple increased their giving again.
As we just began to prosper, you know, we'd give more and more, and like, okay, give $150 this week.
Steve says that's when he learned that good stewardship can mean implementing an idea that comes from God.
I got the idea for building this little camping trailer. I built it and sold it on eBay in a day and a half. I started getting messages from people saying, would you consider building another one?
The company Runaway Campers was born. Within 3 months, they sold 9 more campers. The following year, they sold 140. To date, more than 1,500 people have bought one of Steve's trailers. Many weekends, Steve and Deirdre attend rallies to meet people who bought the campers. And when they do, they're quick to tell them about what God has done in their lives.
And they're like, tell me the story. And I start telling the story, and I've told it hundreds of times. We can say, look at what God has done in our life, not because we're living the American dream or we're making lots of money, but look at the joy that comes when you really just totally give yourself to God. He'll give you more, so much more than you could ask or imagine.
Just look at the joy when you give yourself totally to God. Here's the promise from Matthew 25. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who do nothing, even what little they have will be taken away. And Steve walked that out. Here he is, a pastor. He's teaching tithing. He's living tithing, but he comes to the realization, I'm not doing right with the other 90%. I'm living beyond my means. I've got to bring that into line. And then God gives him a wonderful idea, and he says, that's a great idea. Let's start walking that out. And that simple idea turns into a $1 million business, which is absolutely incredible. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given. So just resolve, you're going to use well what you have, and you're just going to watch God, watch over his word to perform it and perform it in your life.
All right. Well, Steve Shives, he lives about, Well, his business, I don't know where he lives, but his business, which I'm assuming he lives right near his business, and he started it. Well, you know what? Let's look at his business model. Number one, he made something. So the takeaway that we're getting from the Steve Shives business model is we will be having build weekends where we will be building tiny houses, tiny solar houses, off-the-grid houses. So that's one takeaway from Steve. His business is about Anywhere from 90 minutes to no more than 2 hours away from where I'm at right now. And he's about an hour or so away from our Earth Wealth E Village in Hamilton County, Florida. Now, another aspect of Steve's business model, now he's into tiling, so am I. So we've got 4 acres of land. Earth Wealth E Village is 4 acres. So we're taking the first acre, or one of the acres, I'll put it that way, and we're looking at, okay, we're tithing that for community access, where we'll have a solar garden and a solar farm, actually two types of solar farms. One solar farm will be for growing food. The other one will be growing for electricity, and then the solar garden will be a smaller project. But we'll be offering free classes so people can learn about solar electric, photovoltaics, and how to grow their own food, all right, as well as classes, free classes on how to build your own, at least tiny structure or small house, get the fundamentals of it at least, hands-on. We're not selling any books, tapes, DVDs, CDs. We're not selling any online digital courses. This is all hands-on. All right? All free. The only thing that'll cost you got to show up. That's what it costs you. You showing up, physically showing up. And we'll have some things online, too, you know, through Zoom and calls and all that type of thing. So, you know, whatever costs you there, well, it costs you your faith, you getting on the call. But no money transactions with that. So that's what we're, you know what, because we figure that we take care of the community first. We don't have to worry about the financial sustainability with the other 3 acres. So, you know, making something, manufacturing something from raw material, scratch, that's the takeaway from the Steve Shaw's Runaway Campers business model, and making something and taking 25%, not, we could just do 10% of the 4 acres, but I figure, you know what, just easy mathematics, okay, 4 acres, 25% of that is 1 acre, okay, we still got 3 acres, and the acre is equivalent to a football field, so we're good with that. So that's from the Steve Shaw's business model. All right, like I said, we're taking bits and pieces from each one of these business models, and that's how we came up with our business model for our It's My House Housing Outreach.
Welcome to Camp Huguet.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had, and he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far, $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this P.T. Bauhaus style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white, and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up, and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house, except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen, where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator, that's the inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it's the Lawrence little camper. I got this side from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
All right. Well, that's Lauren Nelson. She's 12 years old now. She bought that camper when she was 10 years old. Close, nearing her 11th birthday. She bought it when she was actually 10. But she bought it for four, fixed it up for four. So the part of the business model that we're getting from that is we're going to be building cabins. And we're looking at building them on, based on the size. And we've got about five sizes that we're, four or five sizes of cabins that we're going to be building, taking a page from what Albert Lee would call Amish economics. There's several Amish families make a very good living, generational wealth-wise, by building cabins. So we're going to do the same thing. But a takeaway from Lauren is, you know, her camper is named Camp Huguet. That's her brand. So we're going to brand ours. And the price point. We can build a cabin for $800. We can get a shell for probably the same price she did. Or we can even do a camper just like she did. I've run across a few. I mean, they're online every day. And then you would have to restore it. So although we'll be building cabins from scratch, but we're also looking at buying campers, also known as travel trailers. If we get them at the right price, we can restore those and then resell those and or rent them out. And and this is part of the tithing part, the 25% that we'll be doing on the land, is we'll be teaching people, training people hands-on for free. Well, you know what? Once again, it's going to cost you something. The cost is you got to show up. You got to show up in person, or you can show up online. And then you can ask questions while we're doing a live stream of a live event where we're either customizing / restoring a camper or building a cabin, from a solar home cabin from scratch. $800 or less. Or, you know, I'm going to say around $800. Some might cost a little less. Some might cost a little more. Now, in addition to that, for some people, because a lot of people might want to live in these things, well, that's all right. We'll show you after you get it built on, all right, you build it for $800, and you might sell it for $5,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 and make a profit on it. So all those type of workshops will be offered for free. That's how we're coming out of box. This is, like I said, we're taking bits and pieces from other people's business models. So far we got Steve Harvey's 10x10, which is terrific for scaling. You know what? Apply Steve Harvey's 10x10 methodology, okay, to Lauren Nelson. And let's say Lauren bought something and renovated it for $800, and let's say she sold it for $1,600. So let's say she made a clean $800 profit, all right? And let's say Lauren did that 10 more times with her 9 friends. That's $8,000, okay? And as Steve Harbour says, well, let's say Lauren did that 10 more times, $80,000. And we're talking about within a month. Within a month. Okay. Or a weekend. Because one of the takeaways, business models I'm taking from Steve Shives is they have a lot of runaway camper weekends. Our business model with It's My House Housing Outreach is based on Saturdays and Sundays. How many tiny solar home houses can we buy, can we build on a Saturday? We already have a schedule, thanks to Robin. And how many can we build on a Sunday? Instead of chilling out on weekends, we're using our weekends to work. So times 10 more, that's $80,000 that Laura can earn in a weekend or a month. All right, well, a la Steve Harvey, let's say Lauren does it 10 more times, that's $800,000 that Lauren with the Camp Huguet brand can earn in a month. Or if she, because she could have Camp Huguet weekend retreats, do the same thing. And let's say she did it 10 more times. That's $8 million in a month. The reason why I'm using month instead of year is due to my travels around the globe internationally, I believe that people need, due to inflation, you need to start thinking about whatever you earn in a year, you seriously need to think about how can you earn that amount of money in a month or a week or even a weekend. If you're earning, let's say, $10,000 a year, that's not a whole lot of money in the United States, particularly if you live in a large metro area. Not a whole lot of money. But if you figure out a way on what do you need to do doing what you have already, that one thing that you have already successfully done, what do you need to do to earn that kind of money or $10,000? What do you have to do to earn that in a month? For those who've already done that in a month, what do you need to do to earn that in a week? For others of you who have successfully done it in a week, what do you need to do to earn $10,000 legally in a weekend? I'll leave it at that, at a weekend, because that's the way we're working, is can we do, oh, matter of fact, we already know. We already know that we're going to be building solar cabins and customizing campers or travel trailers. That's where we're starting at. How many can we build on a Saturday? How many can we build on a Sunday? We already have a definite amount. We already have a budget on, this is the budget that we're going to build them for. On the low end, and we're basing it on Lauren Nelson, what she did with $800. We're keeping our stuff real simple, just like the Amish. You got Amish families out here knocking down families now, because in the Amish community, a lot of the Amish community, they have family-based business. It's normal for them. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them have family-based businesses where they build cabins, they build furniture, some of the ladies, they have, you know, they bake goods, man. They bake, they do donuts, they do cakes, they do shoe fly pies, they do baked goods, dinner rolls, you know, loaves of bread. Some of them have little restaurants, you know, meatloaf dinners, chicken dinners. Farmers markets, they get together. Imagine 9 Amish families. And it doesn't, you know what, 9 Amish families get together and put together a farmer's market as their weekend activity. Thank you, Albert Lee, for Amish Economics. 9 Amish families get together. Each one of these Amish families have their own distinct business. But they use the synergy of a weekend farmer's market to sell their gear. Everybody wins. Let's move to another group of people here in the United States, very successful. 9 Vietnamese families or 9 Korean families get together, or 9 Chinese families get together, and they say, you know what? We're going to go and buy a block of property in an inner city neighborhood, and we're going to restore that block in an inner city neighborhood. And I've seen this with my own eyes, and I'm sure some of you have too. And I've met some of the people who've done it that age. And this is going to be our Chinatown. Well, I'm tired of talking about the Amish and the Vietnamese and the Asians and anybody else. Now it's my turn. Or should I say, now it's our turn. We've been blessed with 4 acres in this location, 1.5 acres in another location with 17 lots on it, and we've been blessed with 10 acres in another location. Now it's my house's turn. Here's another business model.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside, with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, well, Lamar Alexander's solar cabin, we're combining that, like I said, with Lauren Nelson's camper, which is a travel trailer. And our retail price that we'll be reselling for will be probably no more than $6,000. You know, if we build something for two, we'll sell it between $5,000 and $6,000. With the solar, depending on, you know, how, because we'll have simple solar systems in there, the power. You know what? We're going to educate you on how you can solarize these type projects, which, you know, if you live on a grid somewhere, you can do the same thing. A big part of this is lifestyle. Okay, it's not the housing technology. That's a part of it, but lifestyle. So we'll teach all of that. All right, so those are the basic business models that we're using. Using the audio, I mean, taking ideas from every audio you just heard, the Steve Harvey 10x10, we'll use that not only for the simplicity, but we'll be able to scale with that. I mean, because once again, if you apply Steve Harvey's 10x10 to Lauren Nelson's Camp Hugue $800 venture, I mean, it's easier to scale something like that. You know, you don't need to go to Wall Street. You know, you don't need to have startups. Well, infinitesimally small, microscopic startup capital. You know, like I said, she was 10 when she bought that thing. 10. She's only 12 now. You know, And some of the ideas that she, I mean, Shops had a dollar store to fix up her place. We're going to be doing the same thing. We'll take an idea, too, from IKEA, where, you know, we build something, but we can build it where we can make it into a kit, and then you can put it together, you know, like a Lego. So all this type of stuff we'll be teaching for free at Earth Wealth E-Village. Now, our long-range goal and what we'll be doing this weekend is reducing, we've already got it, what's that thing? Steve Harvey's got another one, another piece, with division, write division down and make it plain. That way you got a blueprint. So laced throughout all those audios is our de facto blueprint. So we've already got stuff written down, but now we're going to fine-tune what we have written down. And, and once again, for the people that are sending seeds, thank you. Once we get them in the mail, we'll give you a shout-out. And that all goes, like I say, everything starts with one. So it started with one, which was me, then Robin's on board. Then we got people sending seeds. So we'll let you know the progress, and we'll let you know when we'll have our first build weekend. Our goal is to have a build weekend where we have a meal or two every Saturday and every Sunday, and we're building. Because with us, taking a page out of the German culture, they have little villages over there called Dorf, D-O-R-F, small village. That's small village in German, Deutsch. Smallest one that I ever came across where we had just four households. So that's our goal. Every weekend, we want to do a Dorf by building two tiny houses on weekend, Saturday and two on Sunday. Anyway, and then using Steve Harvey's 10x10, we want to reach the factory city level sometime down the road.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
有多少数量？三千个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟准时，二百重量。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive,
even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized department only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of, it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones,
designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute, and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
And on the work side, we have
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here, Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner.
determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu, recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands, and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the Factory of the World.
All right, today's podcast is titled, they're finishing up. All right, Nine Friends Business Models. And we've been, highlighting, which I've done on here a few times, where we're taking bits and pieces from various people's business models and or community models. And one that I've named on here before, and this is more of a community model, is, and I'll post some videos that I personally took of this community later today. They'll be up here this weekend on our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV. On Facebook, our page is It's My House TV. That's our Facebook page on Facebook. Of Vauban, V-A-U-B-A-N, one word. And let me read something about Vauban. Via Wikipedia. Now, Vauban is a neighborhood in the town center of Freiburg, Germany. It was built as a sustainable model district on the site of a former French military base named after Sebastian de Vauban in the 17th century, who built fortifications in the Freiburg while the region was under French rule. Construction for Vauban, this particular solar district, began in 1998. The first two residents arrived in 2001, and I probably visited Vauban '06 or '07, somewhere around there. A sustainable building, and once again, this is on Wikipedia. All houses are built to a low energy consumption standard with 100 units designed for passive as a passive house, ultra-low energy building standard. Other buildings are heated with a combined heat and power station burning wood chips. Many of the buildings have a solar collectors. We call those photovoltaics. Perhaps the best example of solar building is the solar settlement in Vauban. Now, the videos that I'll post today and tomorrow, once again, I personally took these when I was there. And they got some pictures on Wikipedia, but I'm going to show you video. No gas-powered cars are allowed in Vauban. They have a solar garage where when you come up to the settlement, you can either park your car in the solar garage, your gas-powered car. And everybody in Vauban either foots it or they have bicycle garages. Although when I was there, there was a electric vehicle that zipped by me once, but they have like very narrow street paths there. All right, so that's one particular place I've been. I consider Vauban a, because it's got about, they call it a neighborhood, but I consider it a village. It's on the edge of the Black Forest, the Schwarzwald, and about 5 or 6 people, but Wikipedia puts it as neighborhood, but whoever wrote it, probably, I've been to Vauban, okay. So I consider it a little village or a solar district within Freiburg, Germany. Now, another, and I like their business model. I like their community model. And that's what we're doing with our little 4-acre patch up in Hamilton County. We're looking at that community model because I, for one, I don't want to pay no light bill, water bill, and heating bill and all that type of stuff. Now, another place I haven't visited yet in this particular, I've been to many parts of Germany, but I haven't been to this part of Germany yet, and that's Feldheim, Germany, F-I-L-D-H-E-I-M, one word, Feldheim, Germany. Feldheim is Germany's renewable village, and I believe it's, they say it's, in this article, the first renewable, 100% renewable energy village. Although where Ursula Sledeck is, Germany's got some real, got some interesting place to live. Anyway, with Feldheim, experts believe that it could get to 100% of its energy from renewable sources by 2050. This might seem like a distant goal, but one that's already that, well, one that's already been achieved is the tiny village in Brandenburg, Germany, asked the residents of Feldheim to describe their community. There is at least one consistent answer, quiet. The village, which is about 37 miles southwest of Berlin, Germany, Feldheim is home of 128 residents. I keep on saying this. Where the action is, matter of fact, if you ever go to Germany or any country in the world, including right here in the United States, look for the small to tiny towns if you want to experience the real essence or culture of that country. In my opinion, if you go to New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Miami, Los Angeles, those places, that's not the real United States. They're in the United States. But if you really want to get into American culture, go to the little towns of the United States. Matter of fact, on the highest end, I would say the cutoff point would be 25,000 people. No more than 25 to 26,000 people. Anything above that, the towns 26,000 and below, you'll start to get the real parts of the culture of the United States. Now, there's some in one state that really stands out is Texas. Now, Texas is a part of the United States. Because Texas, man, they got their own dialects or different dialects. They got Tex-Mex food. They got their own steak cuisine down that way. Just different than any other. And I've been to about 38 of the 50 states so far. Texas just stands out as different. Okay. But it's part of the United States. But if you really want to get Texas, don't go to Houston, San Antonio, Austin, or the Dallas Metroplex area, which is a pretty interesting area. It's really spread out. But, man, I went to school in Canyon, Texas. I went to school in the panhandle of Texas. Amarillo, Lubbock, you know, where you got Dalhart, Texas, Pampa, Texas, places like that. That's the real Texas. Okay. Where cowboy boots are the norm. You know, just the way the TV show Dallas from time to time caught the real essence of Texas. But that's on the big city level. So Feldheim has got let me be right back where I was reading here. Okay. Where was I? All right. Feldheim is home to 128 residents. On the surface, it's unremarkable. But beneath Feldheim's long street runs a network of electrical cables and heating pipes powered entirely by renewable energy. Once again, if you want to see what's coming tomorrow, go to the small, tiny towns around the globe today. Don't go to Munich or London or New York or San Diego or Moscow, or Lagos, Nigeria. Don't go to the big cities to see what's coming in the near future. Go to the small, all around the globe. Go to the Feldheims of the world. Feldheim is a town that runs off 100. It's a village. It's a village. 128 residents. That runs off of 100% renewables. As I continue to read on. From wind energy to biogas. I mean, they don't waste nothing in Feldheim. I mean, Germans are known for not wasting anyway. Cow shit. That's where biogas comes from. Pig shit. Human shit. Human newer pig. They use all that to power to turn on the lights. So they got wind. They got the village is powered by wind, biogas, and solar. The roots of Feldheim's energy experiment date back to 1995, when entrepreneur and then engineering student Michael Reichman, proposed erecting four wind turbines on land owned by a local farming community. Cooperative. The relatively flat and windy landscape proved ideal. It's easy to get things done in a small, tiny community versus Berlin or Munich or London or New York City. You want to meet the next billionaires? You'll find them in small little communities. Or, well, you'll find people that go to those small communities because now, I mean, with cyberspace, I mean, Zuckerberg basically went to cyberspace and became a billionaire before 30. So did others, but that's another podcast. Okay, so building on the wind farm success, the farming cooperative, and this is what I love about Germany and other parts of Europe, Denmark and Italy, places I've actually set foot in. It's, I mean, you see dairy farmers that turn part of their acreage into solar farms. And they're earning more money with their solar farm than they're doing from dairy farming. So we'll have a little micro solar farm up in Earthwealth E-Village. All right, in any event, built on a wind farm success, the farming cooperative has diversified its business in the face of falling crop prices and rising energy costs. They decided to build a huge biogas plant. See, when you travel these places, including Africa, it's right in front of your face. You're forced to think outside of the box. And it gives you a big leap forward of what might even hit over in this country or other Western countries for 5, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years out. In any event, that facility now turns maize and cereal silage plus a mixture of pig and cow manure into methane, which in turn heats and powers Feldheim's homes. And these are not tiny houses. These are regular-sized homes, but the Germans build different than Americans, but that's a whole other podcast, too. In 2008, the same year that the biogas plant came into operation, Feldheim added a solar farm to their portfolio of renewable energy assets. The farm was built on the site of an abandoned Soviet military center and now produces enough electricity to power 600 households. Now, this isn't something that's going to happen. This is something that has happened and is happening as we speak. 600 households powered by cow shit and pig shit. Again, if you want to see the future now, book your ticket and go to the little. I'm sure there are people right here in the United States on the North American continent, including Canada and Mexico. You got people out there that are doing this too. But I'm just telling you, where the action is with these little small. That's our little four-acre spread. Nobody's paying us any attention. We're not going to have people banging down, beating down the walls to find us. The switchboard doesn't light up to full capacity here on It's My House on a regular, unless we talk about reparations or something like that. But the people that need to that truly believe in reparations, the people that really want that, they're the ones that need this information the most. But then that's another podcast. Anyway, despite the robust development of renewable energy resources in and around Feldheim, there's still major roadblocks to becoming entirely energy sufficient. Utility company EON refused to sell or lease the electrical grid to the village. Now, as I played early in the week and then last week, you know, the nuclear grid that was in the Chenal village in another part of Germany, on somewhere within the Black Forest. That's a beautiful area if you ever get over that neck of the woods. And but it took them 7 years and a few million euro. Well, they were doing Deutschmarks back then. They weren't on the euro system at that point. But they had to buy the nuclear plant and then shut it down and then start their own venture once again. Chenal just got maybe 3,000 people today. But the renewable energy venture that they did with solar takes in over $100 million a year. That's how much it generates. I don't know where the next billionaires will come from, but I'm going to tell you where one crop of them are going to come from, renewable energy, the green billionaires. The Chenal community, Ursula Sebeck, her husband, and her neighbors, they're already doing 100 million. The last time I checked, they were doing over 100 million euro a year. They're probably doing more than that now. So getting back, so this utility company, EON, they refuse or sell the electrical grid to the village of Feldheim. You know what? They'll figure out a way. And we're going to have somebody, two things. We're going to have somebody on here from Feldheim. It's like a 5 or 6 hour time difference between here and Germany. And then we're going to organize a field trip to Feldheim so you guys can see this stuff yourself. But we're taking ideas from Feldheim. For me, now, I haven't been to Feldheim yet, but I've been to Vauban. That's the videos I'm posting online to our Facebook page this weekend. I've been there. So I'm just taking what I saw in Vauban, and we're going to incorporate it in our 4 acres, or anywhere we go. In any event, Feldheim responded by building its own parallel electrical. See, I love it. All right, you won't sell us or lease us any land, so we'll build our own. That's the attitude that we have with Earthwealth E-Village. All right. Feldheim responded by building its own parallel electrical grid and heating network funded by EnergyQuell. EU subsidies, capital loans, and a contribution of 3,000 euro, which translates to $3,266 from each villager. Now, talk about cooperative economics. They've got 128 people that live in Feldheim. That translates into, I think, 37 households. But they ponied up, when you translate it to American dollars, each household ponied up $3,266 and they collectively fired the grid. Thus, Feldheim is Germany. They probably have more. I consider Vauban, they call it, Wikipedia calls it a neighborhood. I consider it its own village. I've been there. I consider it its own village. The grid was switched on in late, now this is one that they did, in late 2010, the point in time from which Feldheim considers itself fully carbon neutral, and since then, local energy prices have dropped by about a third. Let's see. Few renters are still connected to the original grid, and this article goes back, and receive their energy from the same mix of renewable sources as nearly all German households. Role model, with a question mark. The immense amount of publicity given to Feldheim has made it something of a tourist destination. Okay. Residents say they have an average of about 3,000 visitors per year, many from Japan. Okay, which if you want to go see the future, fly to Japan. That's another place. They got stuff going on in Japan. Man, this Asia, point blank, just Asia. Asia's a big place. There's stuff going on a professional level, entrepreneurial level, just a household level, just cultural levels, that I consider the United States and a lot of Western countries, but particularly the United States, is an end market. Stuff gets here last. Okay, let's see. Residents in Feldheim and those involved in its energy project recognize that it will indeed be difficult to replicate the village's success in other parts of the world. Now, let me chime in on that. It'll be difficult to duplicate Feldheim's success in other parts of the world, including other parts of Germany, and this is just my opinion, based on what I call energy politics. The energy company that is in Berlin, Germany, or Munich, Germany, well, let's bring it over this way. In Washington, D.C., Pepco, in the state of California, PG&E, which are monopolies. In Baltimore, you got in Baltimore, Maryland, it's BG&E. That's the household energy monopoly in that city. Now, the city of Baltimore controls the water. They got the monopoly on water. But BG&E, which stands for Baltimore Gas and Electric, they want your electric and they want your natural gas. It's a monopoly in Baltimore City. It'll be difficult to replicate what they're doing, what they've done in Vauban, what they've done in Feldheim, what they've done in Chanel, and what they've done in other little places around the globe, because those utility companies, they don't want you to generate your own household energy. They don't want you to do that. Now, you can go buy your patch of land somewhere else and do it. The only way they want you to have clean energy is if they buy the solar panels, they buy the land, they've set up their own solar farms, and then they generate the clean energy, and they sell it to you. They sell you the solar panels to put on your house. But the best model is what they did in Feldheim and Vauban. The Amish do. DYI and community economics. So, Berlin, Munich, Frankfurt, London, Moscow, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, Chicago, Seattle, Oakland, Albuquerque, Miami, Orlando. You know what? Let them have their monopolies. Now, the cat's out of the bag, because anybody can go renewable now. When it comes to solar electricity, there are plug-and-play systems available now. Cat's out of the bag. A lot of people might not be aware of it, but the cat's out. However, I don't care what they do in the big cities. I look for the Feldheims right over in this. I love towns that have 128 people. Absolutely love them. Because essentially I can do virtually anything I want to do as far as housing and supply and my DYI efforts, or organize a DYI community. See, I can't, for instance, the reason why we have our little spot in Florida, in Hamilton County, is because, man, I doubt if there's 128 people in the location where we're at. There's nothing listed by the Census Bureau. I mean, the closest big place to us is Jasper, Florida. But we're really not in Jasper. Keep on saying Hamilton County. But, what we're doing there is we can't do it in Jacksonville. That's 90 miles away or 90 minutes away. We can't do it in Valdosta, Georgia. That's like 29, 30 minutes away. Can't do it in Tallahassee. We can't do it in Orlando. It's 3 hours away from where I'm at in Central Florida. Can't do it here. We can do part of it here. I'm off the grid with water 100% where I'm at right now. But I'm talking about the whole kit and caboodle. 100% off the grid. That's why I got that 4-acre patch right at that location. Can't do it in Miami. But there's a lot of, because Florida's got 67 counties. And once you get away from the Miamis, the Fort Lauderdales, the Orlandos, the Tampa Bay area, which I guess I live in Tampa Bay. I'm part of the Tampa Bay area. Once you get outside of those areas, Tallahassee and Jacksonville, Florida's essentially rural, and there's a lot of places where you can go off-grid legally. Okay. But I'm not, man, I'm not going to Miami or Orlando trying to preach the gospel of renewable energy and off the grid. And it's not going to fly. The politics of household energy, those energy, you know, and there's enough out here for everybody. So, you know, it works out that way. What will happen in the future with some of these monopolies? Don't know. But I consider myself a regular guy that grew up in an urban environment, and I discovered renewable energy. And I said, you know what? I'd rather go out into a rural area, and I'm sure I'm not the only one like this. For what a person pays to rent a room in a Washington, D.C., or New York City, or Oakland, California, I can buy me an acre or two of land. Now, granted, there's not going to be no Walmart near in many cases, not in all cases. Because the acre and a half that we have out in Taft, Oklahoma, drive 15 to 20 minutes out of Taft into Muskogee, Oklahoma, there's Walmart, there's T-Mobile, there's movie theaters, there's everything that you see in a regular-sized city or a larger city is in Muskogee. 15, 20-minute drive. But where the action is places like Taft. Blackjack, Oklahoma, which is virtually not even on a radar, you have even more freedom, in my opinion. So you'll see in this country, you'll see the next innovations in the little small towns, because there's just less politics, which means you got less bullies. So all that is part of our non-friends business model. Hey, we got to go before they kick us off. Have a great weekend.